HR doesn't like you. It's today, and HR is still fighting for their right to party. After all, we're in charge of planning them, right? This podcast shares edgy, unadulterated stories and perspectives of what it truly means to work in HR. The best part? We don't necessarily like people or care if you like us.
I want people to be able to navigate difficult conversations in a better way. And I realize this subject is boring as shit. So part of the bonus of being a solopreneur, an individual practice, is I can kind of like lean into my weird shit. It's just kind of weird, but I think it'll make a boring subject funny. I think it'll help some of those learnings stick in your mind. And I don't know, some white dude in the 1960s figured out that sex sells. So this is about as close as people ops is getting to sexy.
I think you cracked the nut, no pun intended. Like,
I'm here for the puns.
Suck this pip will forever be burned into my brain.
One of my daily pastimes is doom scrolling on LinkedIn, and it's rare to come across content that you immediately know needs to be a part of your life. That's how I felt when I saw Kim Minnick's post about a month ago that had three words in bold red letters: suck this pip. When I say I couldn't ask her to be a guest on the podcast faster, I was slightly heartbroken when I had to patiently wait a couple of weeks for us to officially connect. Well, dreams come true, and she is here today to talk about her PIP guide coming out on May 15th. Kim has been charging forth in the people ops landscape for over a decade and now deploys her talents in a fractional capacity through her company, Code Traveler HR. We have a really fun and honest conversation about the unfortunate origin of performance reviews, if, what, when, and where PIPs have a place in the modern workplace, and most importantly, serve up enough innuendos to get you to Friday. Enjoy the PIP sucking. I wanted to start with suck this PIP in general, because I saw your content on LinkedIn and it stopped me dead in my tracks, literally, which I feel like is kind of hard to do on LinkedIn these days. It's so crowded and noisy. And I knew immediately that there had to be an HR doesn't like you suck this PIP collab. And we'll get into obviously what that means and what it's all about. But I wanted to have a conversation about performance management for a while now. And I think it's such a saturated topic, or can be, that people are talking about the same thing. And I think we're going to come at it from a different angle and go hard in the paint, as I like to say. And so with that, though, you have a really interesting, I guess, origin story or context to offer around performance management, performance reviews in general. So do you want to lead us in with all of your nerdy knowledge on the history of performance reviews?
Totally. And I'll start, like, I think the suck this pip, that my disclaimer is I'm not an appropriate person. I'm not the kind of person you want to take out in public. I'm a little unfiltered. I'm a little raw. And I think like being able to lean into that brings more humanity and normalcy, and let's call this shit what it is. It's performance management. Let's be real about it. But as I've been leaning in or going hard in the paint on this, it's like performance reviews suck. They just suck. And it's like, why? Why do we feel so demeaned or evaluated, you know? So looking into it, we can trace it back. So we know performance reviews today, they really started in the 1940s. Coming out of the war, businesses started to adopt this evaluation style that the military found very successful. So like, hey, America, bringing stuff out of war. The military started to evaluate their soldiers based on their skills and their potentials. And this is how they started to think about ranks and promotions and doing it in more of like a standardized manner. That practice came from some really gross practices pre-Civil War era of evaluating human labor for their worth. And I think we can see the impact that had on exploited labor, whether it were persons who were enslaved or child labor. Like, we really saw this all over the United States. So like slavery, racism, or so American. And it's just really a gross background. Mm. But that doesn't mean there's not golden nuggets in there. While America was freedoming, there was a study being done in Australia. And I forget the name right now, but they started evaluating workers' productivity in a factory. And what they did was show care for the workers. They would adjust hours, offer flexibility, offer better benefits. Mm. And really started listening to their workers about temperature and light and working conditions. And when we show
go figure.
I know. Whoa, mind-blowing. Treat people well. And so when we really think about, okay, well, how can we take that golden nugget and apply some of the good framework and practices from performance management? So all of that I love. Most people don't. So do it in a way that resonates. Like, let's bring natural language, human language, fun language to this so we can teach the practice.
Right. So I didn't know any of that. And I think it's really fascinating. Just like I learned recently why HR was even conceived, if you will, it was to keep unions out of companies. And so I think all of these origin stories are so important as we try to not only shift the narrative around HR's role, but also challenge HR leaders like you and me to rethink practices and maybe not rethink practices, right? I'm a believer that you don't need to reinvent the wheel. And I think there's a fine line today of, should we call it this? Should we not call it this? Should we have a different name, which we'll talk about more of, like the evolution of just what to call a PIP and even performance. I have, you know, I think there's some esoteric thoughts that you can get into on that. But before we really get into it, I wanted to hear your perspective on the current state of performance management. You've lined it up for this origin story of it, but now we're in 2024. And like you said, are leaning into this concept of suck this PIP, but PIPs are a facet of performance management, right? So kind of holistically, what is your, like, what do you think about performance management and reviews as it exists today?
Yeah, I don't think it's the best words, performance management. I think, like, when I'm working with a company or a business, I do think we need to mold and shape language so it resonates with your population. Mm-hmm. But as a practice, we are talking about managing your performance, your career development, your skills, your knowledge, your abilities. Mm-hmm. And I think it's the term, but it does kind of encompass things well. So, like, look, not everything has a great name, and I'm open. I don't know. Is this like a share in the comments below moment? Like, if you have a better name for this practice, I'm into it. But, like, at the end of the day, it is building a structure, building a framework that clearly identifies expectations, behaviors, and leadership and qualities that you expect at each level in an organization. And that's up with goals, measurable things that are kind of those little rungs of the career ladder. So all of that should be complemented with a structured time to think about career development, compensation, rewards. I think performance management is kind of the basis to all of that. Yeah. So as HR leaders, it's our responsibility to build a framework that anyone can understand, anyone has the opportunity to thrive in, and anyone can, you know, come in and understand, like, oh, this is what I need to do. This is how I need to do it. And this is what I'll get in return. It's work. You know, I think maybe 15 years ago, we swung really heavily into this is your family, whatever. But no, it's work. I'm selling you my time, my expertise. Tell me what I need to do to grow.
Yeah. What I see so many conversations happening, perspectives being offered on performance management. I think for me right now, it feels a little circular. Like, we're all talking about it's really laborious, right? From just a like tactical standpoint, and it's often not done right. And we have HR tech that's being sold that this is going to be your silver bullet, that you're going to, you know, do, this is your solve for performance management. Like, just get a technology and you'll be good. And I think you and I both know like that shit doesn't work either. And so I'm curious, like, what do you think, why are we in like this kind of circular economy, like microcosm of performance where we're probably all tangentially having a similar conversation and it's not getting better. It's not changing. I don't see the shift. So I'm wondering if we like HR leaders, if we were to step outside of that, right, for a second and like bird's eye view, what objectively is not still working? What do you think?
Yeah. The first couple times I really built performance management processes and frameworks, I must say, like textbook gorgeous, and really utilized the tools to the tool's fullest ability. And like, it was beautiful from a people ops perspective. Like, it was textbook perfect. And I found myself herding cats, right? Like, Q3 salespeople do not care about performance management. They care about hitting their quota, right? Like, when a new product is launching, the engineering team doesn't care about performance management. They care about the launch and making sure like everything is going smoothly. So when I stepped back and was like, why am I herding cats? Why don't people love this gorgeous thing that I built for them? I read them now and I'm like, oh God, yeah, no one. It's tough to read. Like, it is very theoretical, if you will, almost. So I think if we really step back, and it's not the tool that makes your process great. Like, your process is great and you find a tool that supports your vision. I think the silver bullet, when I think about performance management, the aha moments of my career, like the best things I've ever gotten were never in a review conversation. They weren't. They were in those nuggets of like quick feedback or deep conversations with my manager about a problem. So I think our frameworks can enable more of those conversations, more of those bite-sized, easy-to-handle opportunities that over time really create a spark or really have an aha moment. So our framework can enable those light bites while still reserving time for a super formal conversation where you talk about how your impact relates to the expectations, how your compensation folds into that, what your 6-month goals are, what your 5-year goals are, and how can we find projects within the business to support that growth. That's performance management. That's a good review system to me. I don't know if it's a silver bullet, but like it at least seems more manageable.
Yeah. I remember like maybe it was 10 years ago even now. Remember when Adobe came out and was pioneering the check-in? I feel like they were the first, at least kind of at a high visibility, where they were like, we're getting rid of performance reviews. We're moving to a model called the check-in, you know, and I think that has cascaded its way into performance management language. I've used 15.5, for example, which is a performance management technology, and they like their bread and butter is built on the check-in framework. So it's like the weekly check-in conversation that, you know, you're documenting the feedback. And I think the problem that I see in this echo chamber of performance conversation, they're being either developed or built or talked about in silos. So anytime I talk to fellow HR practitioners about performance, I always challenge how their performance system or how they're going to build it, how is it working in concert with the other structures in the organization, which for me are compensation and L&D. So I call it like the trifecta: performance, comp, L&D. And I've only one time been able to build all three of those structures in sync with each other so that it was delivered in this really nice package, if you will, of, okay, this is where you are in your pay band. And these are the performance metrics that will get you to the next stage in your pay band. And then here's the learning and development resources that we're going to support you. So they all have to work together. And when I see people building comp structures or building performance or even L&D without this bigger ecosystem in mind, I think that's where we're failing. Because if you're building a beautiful compensation philosophy and structure, which I love to do, but you're not telling people how their performance of how they're going to how they're going to excel. And then you're also not supporting them. Like, it's always going to be broken in my view.
Yeah, I agree. I think they all, I love that, work in concert together. I'm a big fan of like an orchestra sort of thing, right?
Yeah.
Think about like all the different pieces. And I'd add in like, it's not just a three-legged stool. Like there's another piece and that's your operational piece. That's your ability mm-hmm. to report on how you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
If you've got all the philosophies and you've got all the programs built, awesome. And how are we making sure they're working equitably across the board from, you know, low levels to this more senior levels? That really is your people strategy, like your programs and looking at making sure you're supporting your employees as a whole person, right?
Mm-hmm.
Making sure you have great leave programs, making sure you're talking about what happens in low performance very early on. Like I'm talking like day one, like talk about your performance philosophy day one.
So yeah.
Folks know, like make it approachable, because while you're doing your job, I'm creating an ecosystem that anyone can thrive in, that you have the opportunity to grow in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love that add in of like operationalizing the systems, because I actually think that is where HR doesn't necessarily get it wrong. It's that it's actually not resourced well enough to do that. Like I always say HR needs an internal comms person, because you build these systems and then maybe you launch them. But like you're saying, the upkeep and how are people understanding these and applying these, especially if you have a standard hierarchical structure? How are the mid managers creating language and dialogue around these things? And so I think that's absolutely a key point. And especially like the manager piece, you know better than I do, but that is such a critical component of performance improvement plans.
Yeah.
HR is not, and we should talk about this, like the role of HR and PIPs. But before we do that, I want you to formally introduce Suck This PIP and what does it mean? You know, what is PIP sucking and what was your intention behind creating this guide that's coming out in a couple of weeks?
Yeah, so PIP sucking must be consensual. I feel like, you know, no. This kind of sprang from a while ago. I wrote a quick playbook. It's an intensive playbook called Reviews Suck. I talked to my friends, my colleagues, people outside of HR who just have to navigate really shitty performance reviews. Like they just suck. Text anyone you know about performance reviews and I guarantee someone will be like, they suck.
Mm-hmm.
So I wrote this playbook and I was like, but This is fine and great. It echoes a lot of stuff that we talked about earlier, like enabling tiny conversations, structuring the evaluations better. But like the improvement plan was missing, right? And just like
the underbelly, which is like when performance is not happening, I guess.
Yeah, and like, what happens? It happens for a variety of reasons. I myself have been underperformer. It was a great time. But truly, if we think about underperformance, how can we think about really enabling and supporting this person while doing the best thing for the business? I do think performance improvement plans are really intensive development plans. Like, call it what you will, but like the fact is, this is probably the last resort. So we can brand it or frame it in any way, but we are getting all hands on deck to help you find success. And I think there's some key things there. All hands on deck. This needs to be a collaboration between managers, individuals, and HR. Anyway, I was musing about this with a friend. Like I said earlier, I am not appropriate. And I was just like, God, it's like, just suck this pip, dude. And I was like, oh, no. And then I just couldn't get it out of my mind. There is a section about, you know, pips must be consensual. Like everyone needs to be on board. So it's an easy guide to hard performance problems. You know, it's the thing to blow your L&D budget on. It's just a way to approach conversations of underperformance in a better way. Like, let me teach you how to do this in a fun way and then apply your learnings to your framework and your company and your business.
Yeah. Well, I haven't seen the guide yet. It's still sealed. So I'm going to ask you a couple questions.
Yeah.
Is the guide bring you to the moment in time where everyone, and by everyone, I probably mean the manager and HR, have decided like, okay, a PIP needs to happen? Or are you backdating to what has led up to this and now you're at this moment? Because so many times you and I know more than anyone, right? A manager comes to us and is probably like, this person needs to be on a PIP. And then you have to backtrack years of inventory of, well, what conversations have you, is this the moment for it? So
expectations, what do you mean?
Yeah. So what is your, like, what moment are we meeting people at it for suck this PIP?
Yeah, look, I don't think you can get into a PIP sucking conversation without a little bit of a warm up, right? Like,
yeah.
We need to set the stage a little bit. We're not just diving in. So the beginning, yeah, it does explore. Let's talk about what needs to be in place. Let's talk about how to get to this point. So mm-hmm. It doesn't go in super, super deep. But it does kind of give you like, hey, before you go to HR, after all of this is done and before you ask for a PIP, here's some things you should work with your HR partner on. So whether you're building out a program as an HR practitioner or whether you're a manager seeking to learn or an individual trying to have better conversations, it's meant to like really be approachable. From that first inkling, everyone knows they hang up with a call with their boss and they're like, ooh, like from that moment, that's where this starts.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what can we PIP aside just for a second? Because I'm always curious about how we receive the intention for a PIP as HR practitioners, because more often than not, my experience is we're past the point of needing a PIP, if that makes sense, right? It's almost like we have to now backdate this to cover our asses legally, and we're just kicking the can down the road. It goes back to the structures are obviously not working or not operationalized, because to me, the oh shit of we need a PIP, which is like code for, you know,
I need to check
this person needs, yeah. This person needs to like be let go, and we just need to cover our asses and make this a 30, 60, 90 day, whatever process. But from the employee's perspective, they smell smoke. And so I just think I want to get deeper into the conversation of you've produced and created this great guide of how to support people like through the PIP process. And I think there's this real conversation of, which maybe also is in your guide, PIP or exit, right? What is that decision making inflection point?
Yeah. So personal belief, and this comes through in the guide, I don't think we should be putting people on PIPs if we know they're not going to be successful. It's just insulting. It's insulting to everyone involved. Now, that being said, I do think we need to coach managers through some very real and some very tough conversations before we get to a PIP conversation. So manager comes to me, I want to put this person on a PIP, but you just gave them an exceeds expectations. What happened in the last 17 seconds? And I think really, like, look, you need to have some open and honest conversations about how performance isn't meeting it. And they need to be documented in a way that anyone can understand there's an issue here. And we need to have some reasonable talks about what good looks like. But if we're just doing it to check a box, if there's no way this person's going to meet expectations, one, are the expectations insane?
Yeah.
Or are they spoken? Like, let's dig into that with the manager.
And
really think about like, whoa, let's back up. What have we done to ensure this person would be successful? Or did we move the goal? What happened? And after kind of better highlighting that, I think we can better craft conversations because there's nuance. Like, whether or not someone brings their whole self to work, let's consider the whole person. Are they going through some tough times? Is this a long-term hire or a new hire? Did the role change? I don't know. Let's actually support somebody before, again, we do this all hands on deck approach. So yeah.
Yeah. I feel like the initiation of even just a PIP conversation, right, many steps away from it actually being put in place is, I think, and maybe you feel this as well, is like it's kind of targeted, if you will, maybe for managers more like than HR, because we know what's up. Again, like sometimes we have to placate the situation because of all the things we just said around making sure that we're covered, but holding up a mirror to managers really of being like, like, this is a training guide almost. Yeah. How are you showing up as a manager? Because I think it's often like they use it as a scapegoat to just be like, I can't deal anymore, right? This person, yeah. It's not working. And I, as an HR leader, when that happens, my empathy for the employee actually goes into overdrive, probably maybe to a fault, because I more than not think it's the manager not setting expectations, not managing their team or their person well. And now I have to help clean up the mess. And so I'm always like, what's going on with the employee? Do they know what they're supposed to be doing? All of these things that I'm kind of like teetering now on advocating more for the employee when a PIP comes down the pipeline, but being the HR person who has to deploy it, it's like, it's so emotional.
And again, like, if it's not right, don't do it. Like, offer, yeah. Like, if you're going to spend 30 days or 60 days half-assing it, pay out a severance.
Yeah.
Pay out a severance equal time. Create an offboarding, create a supportive offboarding and exit plan. And, like, really, yeah. Like, help end that relationship if it's the right thing to do. But, yeah, this guide, it's an easy guide to hard performance problems. So, like, experienced HR practitioners, you'll have some good laughs. You'll enjoy it. Folks who maybe need to build out, I'm a big fan of, like, transparency in HR programs and people operations. Mm-hmm. So if you want to build out a more transparent approach to performance reviews and then complementing it with underperformance, these two guides will really help you bring that to a documented way that hopefully employees will find engaging enough to read and not just skim over.
Do you see, or is it your philosophy that PIPs can be co-created?
Yeah. So I think they should be co-created. I think they are a bit of a living document, right? If you have, I mean, it would be aggressive, but if you have a 30-day PIP, like, there should be at least two check-ins just exclusively talking about performance. So how, you know, what resources have been given to support you in your development that needs to happen? What progress has happened? Are we seeing progress that maybe isn't quite up to the goals, but like, mm-hmm. a B+ is good enough to at least extend for 30 days, you know? I think they can be dynamic because, again, we can't predict the future. We're working with humans and nuance and new information every day. Businesses change over 30 days. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I do think it's like kind of co-created. This is what we need to see. Like, how does this resonate? And again, that's why it's all hands on deck. Your HR partner, mm-hmm. can come in and help support those conversations, mm-hmm. in the goaling and metric and reporting and overseeing the whole program, right? Are we seeing pockets of this somewhere? Are we seeing trends with a manager? I think those are really important, mm-hmm. insights to think about when implementing these more formal and supportive improvement plans.
Yeah. I actually, within the last couple of years, learned of a term that I hadn't heard before, and it was called a glide path. And it's like a fancy term for an exit. But yeah. I liked it because, at least in the scenario and how I learned it from this person who came from like a huge corporate machine. And, you know, sometimes like those tools and processes don't work in the confines of a startup, which is what this was. But sometimes the language can actually be helpful. And the glide path concept wasn't just like, we're going to agree to exit. It was actually acknowledging that the role had changed or that the person's skills were not necessarily aligned with the role from, you know, maybe I think in this case, it was the hiring manager like didn't hire the right person. And then that hiring manager was gone. And now you're left with a mismatch in skills. So it was acknowledging, like, here is the new role. We believe that you could grow into it. And we want your input on, do you want to grow into this? What are the skills? It was kind of like this mini rehire process where we were very upfront owning, right? I think it's the trauma that I think comes from performance management conversations can be alleviated to some extent by the quote unquote, the business. I don't know why I say quote unquote, like it is a business, but the organization taking ownership first of, this is where we've misstepped, or, you know, especially in a startup, roles evolve really fast and the skills needed. And so we kind of issued this like strategic project. So it was like, here's the new role description. And then, you know, how would you approach this role and growing into this role in the next 3 months? And so in that case in particular, it was like, you can do this. And like, we can have a conversation about it, or we can have a glide path, which means we gracefully exit like 2 weeks notice. We make it seem like it was your decision. And in this case,
or we communicate it in a joint way, in a way that you feel.
Yeah, it's like it's a like, shared.
Hey, this is
it's more that anymore. Co-creation.
Yeah.
You know, and this person, admittedly, we didn't see that talent matching the task, which is also another term that I like, talent to task. But and she didn't even do the project. She was like, I don't
not
because it. Right. There was a lot of other things, but like that was the outcome we kind of knew. But like she got to make that choice. The role was hers if she wanted it. But it just felt so much better. I don't really have any like words for it, but it just felt better.
Well, I think it's important to offer choices and offer equitable choices. Like, hey, look, this role has changed. This is what we're thinking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what resonates with you? What's exciting about this? Here's how we would support your development.
Yeah.
Right? Like you have to, as the business, if you're offering a change, lay some foundations, like give a helping hand. I think that choice is important. And then allowing the employee, look, performance improvement, you're breaking trust. It's irreparable. Likely the person is going to leave, whether it's, you know, at the end of the improvement plan or within the next year. But like, I don't know, if we structure it well and we really do it with the person's career development in mind, maybe after reflection, maybe after you step away and it doesn't feel so gross, like, oh, actually, I did learn something. And like,
Yeah,
that's my intention, right? Like, how can we do this in a way that no matter what, you learn something, but learning is an investment. We're all going to invest in it.
Mm-hmm.
Have to be into it.
And I would say the example that I had was amplified more because that like trifecta of structures wasn't in place, right? Like we didn't actually have a formal performance management system codified because it was a startup and we just weren't there yet, which is also where I think the accountability of the business. And that's where I see the most begrudging breaks in trust happen, is that especially in smaller organizations, startups specifically, where these structures are not in place, but yet we're holding people to standards of the structures that exist in our minds that are not yet built. And then we come to them and we're like, you're not meeting the expectations. Like that's where I think we're also stuck in performance, is like that's happening and we're not realizing the things that don't exist.
Yeah. Look, I love transparency. I love documentation. I'm people ops. You have to codify it. You have to write it down. You have to make it public to the organization. The expectations have to be clear. Otherwise, like, how did I not meet expectations that I didn't know existed? So I think it's really important to lay all of those frameworks. And if you don't, look, I get it. I've worked in startups. Maybe you don't have it.
Mm-hmm.
Before you come talk to me about a PIP, come talk to me about the performance issues. And what we're going to do is craft a 60-day plan.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be softly documented. It's not a performance improvement plan, but you and I are going to outline some clear goals for this person, some clear expectations. And I want to know how your conversation goes over the next 60 days. Startups move fast, but like you can't just throw people overboard, you know?
Exactly. Well, that's the contention that I've faced, as you know, most as working in startups for the better part of the last, you know, half of a decade. And I see that. I mean, I had a founder who wanted to fire the head of a business unit while he was on parental leave without even trying a PIP, or right? And I was just like, this is also not it, you know? And then we have, again, kind of that, the overdrive of empathy for the employee. For me, it's kind of this like justice that kicks in where I'm like, this is not okay. Like we can't be treating people like that. And I think that's because I've had such traumatic experiences around witnessing and also just like quote unquote performance conversations for me that like,
yeah,
I never want people to feel the way that I have felt. And so and that leads me into like kind of this discourse around calling it a PIP, a performance improvement plan. Even what you just said around, it's not going to be this, but an employee, like any kind of performance conversation, whether maybe you call it a PIP or not, like alarms will start to go off. Your nervous system gets impacted and it's a visceral, right, feeling. And I think that's also the other reason performance is just like so complicated, is the literal physical response that I think we have almost like generational trauma around the word performance and how it's been conducted going back to the origin story. And so I've been in organizations where I'm like, I don't want to call it a PIP. Like, it's such a bad name. It's going to invoke this really negative response. And it's going to, right? It's like, I talked about this on another episode with my coach, like this concept of threat mode. Literally, like the front of your brain just like shuts off. And like, you can't, any tools that you have, like you can't function like rationally anymore. And I do think there's a little bit of the language we use that is negatively supporting those reactions or responses. And we kind of talked about, well, we can call it something different, but it still is what it is, right? So what do you think about more of like the actual bodily response to performance?
Yeah. So I think there's a lot of things to tease out. And the first thing I'll say is I am fortunate that I'm in a spot where I get to like talk about these frameworks in the perfect manner. But I myself have been in conversations where I'm like, I advised on the risk. I coached the founder. I coached the CEO. I did everything I could, but ultimately I am not the decision maker. So like, just as I was saying something earlier, I was like, yeah, but I've fucked these conversations up too. So I do think as HR practitioners, the more we can coach and make these learnings stick with our managers, the hopefully easier these conversations have, the easier these conversations become. And again, like, we have to look at the holistic picture, right? It hurts a lot more when you thought somebody who was like your family is now telling you you're not good enough. Ooh, that stings a lot more than, oh, maybe this job role wasn't right for me for all of these reasons, but now I have a very clear documented way to either meet these expectations or decide if this role is right for me. So I don't know, I kind of went off on my own tangent there, but I think the names matter if you have the ability to back up the branding. Like branding people programs takes a lot of educating. If it's called something else, but it's still hurts, does it matter it was called something else? Or are you backing that cute, approachable, crafted brand up with the right experiences too? So if you are going to rebrand it with an intention, make sure the actions and the programs match that intention. And then make sure you're educating and training folks on it from day one and reinforce it, right? Like, all of this is part of performance management. So we talk about it all. It's not always good and great. It's also support and help and exit sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've seen performance success plans pop up. I think myself, I've used the term action plan. I think, and I'm probably just biased from my own experience, because I think the switch that goes off and shuts down like the entire switchboard when you hear performance improvement.
It's scary.
It's just really hard. And I don't think we are doing a good job of setting expectations. You and I are talking about that's what needs to be done and all of, but in reality, like that's actually not helping, you know? That's not happening. Yeah. So are we trying to skirt away? Are we trying to skirt the problem by calling it something nicer because managers and maybe even HR building the programs aren't doing a good job, right? Facilitating this garden bed that needs to be planted of how to set expectations.
Yeah. I mean, the garden bed needs to be planted and then watered and tended and weeded. Well, pretty gardens don't stay pretty with no maintenance.
Yeah.
So yeah, if it's a program, call it whatever you want. If you have ideas, call it whatever you want. Ultimately, if the end of this document is, if we don't see the improvement in the next 30, 60, 90 days, you may be terminated. We're still doing the same action. So to make it, I don't know, an easier pill to swallow. What if on day one, week one onboarding, you were introduced to the holistic performance management? Here's how to grow your career. Here's how to maintain your career. Here's what happens when people aren't hitting the bar. And here's the conversations we have. And here's what those documents look like. So like, if you're starting to smell smoke, you could go go just read about it and at least be like, okay, by the time my manager starts having these formal conversations, is this something that I want to commit to? Or, you know, should I think about my own exit strategy? Like,
yeah,
would that decrease those scary feelings when, again, you're empowering the employee with knowledge and information mm-hmm. and the ability to make the choice? I don't know. It's a shitty conversation. This is one of the worst parts of our jobs. But also we have a responsibility to do it well. We're all adults. We're all in a professional environment. I think we can have these conversations in a really professional and kind and supportive way, even if it means we need to part ways.
Well, I think what you just said for me made me think of how, kind of back to consent, but consent not at the pip, you know, the pip sucking stage, consent at this is a shared endeavor relationship, right? Kind of as an employee, like you also need to be having ownership and awareness of your contributions. And I like the word, again, I'm a little more on the camp of some of these terms I don't love. So I like contributions over performance, but are you aware if your contributions, you're like, you're proud of your contributions so that you're not blindsided when these conversations start to happen?
Yeah, I think that's such a great point because it's not just your goals. It's not just the metrics you're obtaining, but it is your contributions. And particularly as we progress up the career ladder, most companies have expectations for not just your outcomes, but your behaviors. And like, you mm-hmm. can have behavioral performance improvement plans. Mm-hmm. You know, no one likes working with a brilliant asshole. And those conversations are tougher, and those performance conversations are tougher. But again, am I going to put you on a performance improvement plan over behaviors that you've been coached on for a year and haven't changed?
Yeah.
I don't know. So to empower the employee, again, like, write these expectations down, even if it's just something that you can like point to and say, hey, here's what we expect from. Break it down, make it easy. Early stage career professionals, senior leadership. Even the smallest org probably has those three levels. And just talk about the contributions you expect and the goals and how it's structured, and give a trail map.
Yeah. Yeah. And I like the header contributions because I think you can break it down to these are the behaviors. Maybe you call them the qualitative, and then behavior. I've seen it like in a career architecture framework. Contributions are behaviors, technical aptitude, impact. And then there's also a leadership if you're in a leadership or manager position. And those categories, if you will, are all signaling this antiquated performance term, but we're breaking it down so it feels a little more aligned, I would say, with like modern day terminology. And I think that's where I sometimes take umbrance with PIPs. You know, that's what we've been calling them. But to your point, it still is what it is.
I mean, I like new language. And look, this is all, I treat this almost like how I treat my very cringy LinkedIn postings. My thought process is very formal. It's very HR-y. I do love the impact, the KSAs. Like, I want to get nitty gritty into that framework. And it's intimidating. It's intimidating. Nobody mm-hmm. wants to read it. And then you get into cycle, well, we documented it, but nobody read it. And it became stale. So I think if we write these expectations in a really human-centered way, in a way that people mm-hmm. are like, oh, not only do I understand what's expected of me, I can clearly see what's expected of leadership. And I see that reflected in the day-to-day. This actually mm-hmm. makes sense. And that's, gosh, it sounds so easy, but that's why people ops professionals exist.
And why our job is fucking hard.
Yeah, like the simple elegance of a well-crafted career framework that people can understand and engage with. My God, it's tough. It's like a circus artist, right? I do aerial arts as a fun hobby. And like, when you go see a Cirque du Soleil show, those people work to make it look so easy. And I think that's maybe what people don't see about people ops. If it's an easy program that's engaging and you understand and it's done transparently, so much effort went into that.
So true. The last thing I wanted to ask you about was if we're taking on maybe a role of challenging conventional practices around performance management, terminology aside, do PIPs still have a place in that? And you've said, I have maybe more traditional, PIP is a traditional thing, and I'm not knocking on it. I do think they are still a great tool, and I'm so excited to dive into your guide. And I think we can challenge conventional practices and still hold some things. If it's not broke, don't fix it. And so while people are having this chatter around performance management is broken, but we're also not doing the things that we need to do. So like, let's just do the things that we know. Where's that fluidity for you?
I think it's more of standing on the shoulders of giants, right? The practices are old, but an orchestra is still beautiful even without new instruments. You can still make new music with instruments that have been around for hundreds of years. So like, why can't we do that with our frameworks? Why can't we take the pieces that we know work, mold them into the organization so they're genuinely helpful? So we're genuinely using these tools in a way that support the people and integrate with the business. We can still make beautiful music, but an oboe is still an oboe. A bassoon is still a bassoon. An improvement plan may still be an improvement plan. Doesn't mean we can't add some funk to it. Yeah.
I think that's a really smart analogy, because for me, my intention with these conversations is defying a little bit of the archaic narratives, which, as we started this conversation, the origins of performance, I think, would fall under that category. And I think there is this, again, all of the behind the scenes that you don't see HR leaders doing is finessing, like, and trying to almost come to terms with what is forward for a lot of these structures.
Yeah. And I don't think it's reinventing the tools. I think it's using the tools in a better way. Mm-hmm. So we can, again, you can call it whatever you want in your organization, especially if you have the power to support that new branding. Mm-hmm. But maybe that is a song. Maybe that's your title of a song and you're still using like these instruments. And I think that's why it's so important to have a level of strategic people ops expertise in your business to be able to understand how all these tools work and how to mold them into your business. So it is harmonious. So it is, you know, something people want to engage with. Mm-hmm.
No, I think that's so beautiful. Let's go back to a little more of the crass around my favorite topic of the hour, which is pip sucking in general, and just how you've so cleverly and defiantly branded this. When people can get your guide in a couple of weeks, what are you hoping the takeaway is?
Yeah, so kind of the background is talking with friends and, you know, when you are HR, like, people come to you for HR questions.
Oh yeah.
And just being
my bill for free HR advice is like longer than I've been alive.
I'm like, but so glad to do it. Like, I love when some of my dearest friends navigate difficult conversations because I empowered them. So that is the takeaway. I want people to be able to navigate difficult conversations in a better way. And I realize this subject is boring as shit. So part of the bonus of being a solopreneur, an individual practice, is I can kind of like lean into my weird shit. It's just kind of weird, but I think it'll make a boring subject funny. I think it'll help some of those learnings stick in your mind. And I don't know, some white dude in the 1960s figured out that sex sells. So this is about as close as people ops is getting to sexy.
I mean, I think you cracked the nut, no pun intended. Like, hey, no,
I'm here for the puns.
Suck this pip will forever be burned into my brain. So thank you for giving us that into the world.
HR Doesn't Like You is presented by Fun Police Press and hosted by Emily McMahon. It would be so nice if you rated the podcast, and better yet, send us an email for topic requests or general commiseration. Our email is hello@hrdoesntlikeyou.com. That's hello@hrdoesntlikeyou.com. See you soon.